Darlings, before we get to this week's show, I'd like to invite you to come see me live. That's right, the Luminaries will be posting up once a month at Housing Works Bookstore Cafe in Soho. Heard of it? And our very first edition is going to be a banger. Thursday, June 6th at 7 p.m., I'm interviewing the supreme stunt queens of comedy, Sydney Washington and Marie Faustin. There's going to be a full bar, hot people, and a little dance party courtesy of DJ Swoon. It's $8, and I want to see looks. Come wearing culottes. See you there, moi. They're all here. The divas, princes, and living legends you should be obsessed with. Sitting down with me. I'm David Goldberg. These are the Luminaries. Today I'm speaking to Emily Allen and Leah Hennessy, creators and co-stars of the new play Slash, which hits Joe's Pub on June 10th. Slash is a lurid plunge into the worlds of erotic fanfiction, often written by women. In the play, the two stars blast through time, space, and fandoms, from Kirk and Spock to Ivanka and Tiffany Trump, in an endless fractal dance. Allen and Hennessy are also two parts of the cult downtown web series Gigi. For this interview, we're joined by their fellow Gigi creator and star, Ruby McAllister. So before we get into anything, I kind of need to stage an intervention for myself. This is what's going on. The last three fiction books I've read have all been of a very specific subgenre. First, there was Madeline Miller's The Song of Achilles,
yes,
which is a very gay, well, it doesn't need to be a gay retelling because the original story of Achilles and Patroclus is gay. Then I tried to go through a Mary Renault phase with Fire from Heaven, which is her retelling of Alexander the Great, but I got bored. And now I am going through this very intense, as Ruby knows, Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley phase, which is the woman's they're taking notes right now, which is a woman author retelling the King Arthur story. I'm noticing a lot, and I know that you two have a lot of expertise on this subject, and I guess where I want to start with it is I have never read anything so mellifluous and fabulously Baroque in my life, just in terms of, I mean, this is kind of why I had to stop reading Mary Renault, but she would describe a bowl of grapes over paragraphs and paragraphs, and especially with Marion Zimmer Bradley, there is just like, oh God, in Avalon, these fucking goddess rituals where they're just like slathering Arthur in blood and then putting the horns on him and then he's fucking his sister. But it's like, it's so drawn out and it's beautiful, but it's just very different to me because I'm more used to the like, well, even if you think about the movie Troy and you compare that to Song of Achilles.
Which I do think about right. often.
Yeah, and, really doing some major Leah Hennessy keywords here.
Okay.
Think about Troy. Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just thinking about the structure of Song of Achilles, mm-hmm. and which I really have to thank you. We wanted to come here today to thank you for turning us on to Madeline Miller. And I feel also if any of our friends or anyone who I've ever talked to is listening to this,
you're all canceled
because no one except David Goldberg told us to read Song of Achilles, which is a best selling book. Circe, I tried to buy online. You can't get that book secondhand.
Actually, we tried to order it from the library, and the librarian was like, yeah, 200. You can. You're 1,000th in line.
It was literally your number 247.
Why it took off. I don't know why Circe is the one that's everywhere. It's on every goddamn M train
I've
been on.
Well, Circe is excellent also. I love Circe and Song of Achilles equally. They're separate but equal, and I think they're great, but like... But I think that one of the things I was thinking about with Song of Achilles is that it structurally is pretty conventional. It is like a normal kind of coming of age novel in a way.
Absolutely.
And it's not, in that way, it's really not like fan fiction or slash fiction. Whereas something like Mists of Avalon, which is where is the beginning, where is the end? Like she tacks on this really. Did you finish it?
No, but it doesn't matter.
Well,
let me just say,
at the end, there is this, like, at the end of Mists of Avalon, that first book, there is this, like, novel with a capital N epilogue that like sums it all up, and you're like, "Oh, this was a real book," but actually, it's
and
not.
It feels like that was like an editorial afterthought,
an editorial intervention.
Yeah,
yes, because exactly. it could have gone on infinitely, like it as truly, episodically.
Truly, but it's interesting you say that because the inverse I would say is true of Song of Achilles, where the Iliad I don't really know where it starts or begins, and then Song of Achilles is this like. Almost Tumblr ready, hyper concise, like, I was a boy and he was Achilles, then he died, then I died. Like, it's so, it's so, like, packaged. I guess I'm just curious about, I don't know, what I'm kind of reeling with is, like, this just is not what gay men do. Like, this is not what I'm used to. I'm more used to gay men, like, sticking their dicks in it or, like, making it a joke or making it drag, which is great and fully reverential.
There's, in terms of erotic, in terms of erotic of, fiction, or what? In terms of
in,
what?
Right. In terms of like retelling kind of iconic or legendary mythology, or just even like what you two do with Slash. If gay men did that, it would be just drag, which is fine. But there's something about this specific thing, which is women retelling the stories of either legends or history or pop culture, where it's extremely serious. And I think that's what I was trying to get at with the beginning in terms of the kind of hyper mellifluous writing is like, I'm just curious about that aspect. And even when you look at Tumblr, like I remember the Vampire Diaries Tumblr pages would be sepia tone, black and white, like dead serious. This is not a fucking joke. And I'm just curious about that, where that comes from, how you guys have been interacting with that in this process. And I know that's a lot.
No, I think this is obviously something we talk about. And I think that what drew me to the world of fan fiction, like really overdosing on fan fiction and reading, you know, 72 chapter alternate universe.
Richard III, Sherlock,
yeah.
AU.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah, that's a classic. It's Sherlock and John of the BBC show, of the BBC Sherlock in as Richard III and Hamlet. Isn't there like, it's like a mashup Shakespeare. And it's like this, yeah, like 72 chapter, totally indulgent, you know, like endless.
Death and resurrection.
Yeah, and like endless pages about like the tapestries, like these poorly researched, historically inaccurate, like, you know, odes to like the bed, the hangings around like King Watson / Richard, you know, bed tapestries, you know, like that. And it's shameless and it's way too extra and it's so indulgent. And like, I do think there's something, I hate to call it feminine, but there is something in a tradition of women writers that like I really love and respect, like, you know, like someone like Angela Carter, who like for me, when I read Angela Carter for the first time, I felt like, oh, like I could write the way I want to write, or like what I have to say as a writer could actually matter in a way. And like, I didn't know that I felt that way before I read Angela Carter, but like, and there is like a,
I'm not allowed. I'm not allowed to write this. I can let myself go.
Yeah. And like the shamelessness of like indulging in beauty, or the shamelessness of like purple prose, you know, and like I remember being in middle school and like learning the concept of purple prose and being like, okay, like let me just like make like what, like don't say anything, like be Hemingway, like you know, keep it together, you know,
Be Hemingway, keep it together.
Yes, queen.
whether or not you know, Slash fiction is like a feminine, or fan fiction is a feminine form, there's definitely a feminized stigma attached to
it.
Yes. And at the end of Song of Achilles, there's a interview where Gregory Maguire interviewed Madeline Miller.
Oh, God.
Another, you know, book I read this year that Leah put me onto. Put me onto Wicked, if you haven't read it. You know, check it out.
I would another, like, Wicked could stand for a little more indulgence.
I think so, too. I mean, yeah, specific. I think it really falls off in the
like
second
in,
half
in
of the
one,
well,
in,
as a militant terrorist. More anyway,
but with, we'll get into
that
Wicked
militant.
I would like to hear that. Yeah,
Storyline just totally drop. It's like kind of reactionary. But anyway, what I was going to say was that he asks her something about fan fiction, and she says she describes showing her boyfriend an early version of Song of Achilles and him saying, "Aren't you scared people are just going to call this fan fiction?" And
which the New York Times pretty much did.
And she said, "You know what? Like, this is my book. This is my story. I want to write the story of Achilles and Patroclus as I understand it. And if people call it fan fiction, they call it fan fiction." I also just want to say, we got an email from our friend Sparrow, the poet Sparrow.
Legendary who, New York poet.
East Village luminary in his own right. But who wrote to us saying that he was thinking about our play Slash, and one of the things that it brought up for him was that, you know, Shakespeare was just writing fan fiction. All the characters, you know, which is, you know, it's kind of like a meme, like hits blunt, like... You ever think about how Shakespeare is just fan fiction? Like, he's just writing about Richard III and stuff. But
I think that the idea, I think that, you know, obviously we all know this, you know, the idea that the presumption that content is supposed to be original, that like a novel is supposed to be an original idea with new characters, that's like a pretty recent idea, and or that theater is, you know, like this idea, this like this standard of making up fresh characters. And I think that in a way, you know, with like the trend going on now with like, let's remake like Charmed and Sabrina, and I don't know why those are the same things. There's a lot more variety, but like
Shrek the musical.
Shrek the musical,
which I of course can relate this all back to 9/11, but keep going.
Right,
but
let's get into that.
we should
get into that.
But yeah, there's, you know, and there, and you know, there's this kind of, there's this kind of like there's this kind of like posturing, like that's not what we all want, and like that's not normal.
But which,
like,
of course, it is what we all want.
And it's normal. Right. And it's you know, you work on the myths you have available to you. And why would you create an original character and you know, there's only 12 stories or whatever anyway. Mm-hmm. So yeah, something being just fan fiction is, like, a totally outdated.
No, of course, because,
totally,
listen,
dude.
I mean,
Let me...
the Marvel movies are only doing well because they're predicated on this notion of, like, well, these are stories that you kind of already knew from childhood. But it's like, no one knew Guardians of the Galaxy when I... No one.
No,
I can tell you, no one has ever heard of that.
But
the idea that it existed in the 70s gives it this sense of, like, safety and this... You can trust it. You're not being sold ostensibly a lie of something new. Because I think people know now. It's all bullshit. Like, the idea that you're crafting something new and original is male propaganda.
Yes.
Definitely. You know what just came to mind was that, this is just an idea, it just came to me, I'll just test it on you guys. If Shakespeare was writing fan fiction, maybe Shakespeare was a woman.
Boom. You know, that was in the... Did you see that yesterday? And BBC did publish, I think, Shakespeare's a Woman article. And I think...
Emily Psychic, so...
Yeah, no, I know. The Cassandra of our
group,
like,
my,
is really...
telepathic powers are
she's always on game. She's always on point.
The BBC piece was written by Jermaine Greer in hiding.
Hot! It's getting hot in here.
Yeah. So let's go back to Wicked for a minute, because Wicked to me is actually a perfect example. Okay, so Wicked, you have this book that is, to me, more as if it was written by a woman, because it's so serious.
Yes!
Okay, but it's more in line of that, like, very serious, reverential, hyper-political story. But then you have the musical, which is fag. The musical is, like...
written by a woman.
Yes,
which is actually written by a woman.
Are we allowed to say that?
That what?
The musical is written by a woman.
It is.
Okay.
It's written by
sign an NDA for that.
It's the musical.
It's the woman
who wrote My So-Called Life. It's Winnie Harlow.
Shut the fuck up.
That's her name. No, not Winnie Harlow. That's that model.
It's Winnie Marlowe.
Can you imagine that?
That's that beautiful model. No, it's Winnie something. Yeah. She didn't write the music, but she wrote the book.
Winnie?
She wrote her name is
Holzman.
Winnie Holzman. Yeah, Winnie Holzman wrote Wicked. But so I disagree that Wicked is is I mean, we're using just a disclaimer. These ideas like feminine and masculine writing are just wrong and stupid. But let's proceed because I think they're really useful. But they're like just totally.
But they're just stupid. But something's going on.
But we're talking and it's important. But like I think that wicked to me is it's important because we're talking.
Because we are talking right now.
So listen, I think everything we're saying wrong. Should you continue to listen? Absolutely.
And that we're saying it is what's important.
Okay, but so to me, wicked is not feminine because it's self-important and it's deliberately like not marginalizing itself and it's self-serious in a way that's conceptual. And I think that there's a gimmick of wicked, which is this like kind of highfalutin morality, which Gregory Maguire doesn't deliver on, which is like I can't get into the whole Wicked series, but I think that there's a seriousness of intent with Wicked, which is like rewriting the morality, and it's not so much about the actual experience of Elphaba the witch, and I think that that's where it actually fails, is that like I think that it comes from
a little bit into the like sensory descriptions of her, the difference of Elphaba.
There's some of that, but I think it falls
and
off.
It's not enough.
Yeah. It's not enough feeling. And I think that he got trapped in making it an important
morality story.
An important morality story and like a vague political allegory. And I don't actually think it's indulgent enough.
What I mean to say is that those aspects and also the aspects that the story, I think, kind of goes all over the place in a similar not necessarily similar to Mists of Avalon, but in that way. Okay, so you have that, but then when it goes to Broadway, you have that story which doesn't really make sense on Broadway, and then what is taken... So you have the serious kind of the novel's fandom, which I think would be more in line with what we were talking about, and then you have the show, which has been swept up by gays because it's, like, big and...
Fab,
but to me there's such a dissonance between, like, what each fandom is taking from each piece. And that's what I meant to bring up.
Yes, right. That's totally true. And I mean, you could write, like, a whole very self-serious thesis about the total cognitive dissonance of the transition from Wicked the novel to Wicked the show. Mm-hmm. Because it's the weirdest... We just were in this world for a really long time because we were writing a Wicked adaptation, and so we.
I just got chills because I forgot.
And so we were trying to reconcile the world of Wicked, the musical, with Wicked the play is just. I can't even make a connection.
So fragmented.
Yeah, I've never felt
the cognitive.
It's too weird. And then also even going into like, you know, the Wizard of Oz, we're both crazy Wizard of Oz fanatics in a really serious, not ironic way. And it's like the Wizard of Oz is this sprawling, I will say the word, queer, decentralized, strange, just fundamentally strange world that's discontinuous. Like I'm trying to write an Oz thing and the lack of continuity and like the constant retconning is so frustrating for me because it's like I actually do cling to some kind of linear narrative and like the world of Oz is so indulgent, self-contradictory, queer, weird, and fragmented. And then the fact that it became this like not monolithic, but this like classic canon film, which has like the clearest George Lucas kind of beginning, middle, end hero's journey. That's like not native to L. Frank Baum's Oz even. Mm-hmm. So the point is that Oz is just like an endless.
It's so weird that you know, I've been thinking of back to King Arthur because when I just read T.H. White's The Once and Future King, it's also. a fucking, like, I don't know what was going on with those closeted Englishmen in the middle of the century, but it's fucking, like, it's all over the place. There's weird retcons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Guinevere just, like, pops up with no introduction. Morgos is there, like, skinning cats, but you don't even know who she is. Like, mm-hmm. It's a complete mess. Mm-hmm. So, there is something to be said about that. But then you switch over to Gregory Maguire or Marion Zimmer Bradley, and you get these kind of overly... not present, but like in the womb, pulling the baby out, kind of zoomed in versions.
Mm. That's really interesting. Yeah, that it's. Yeah. I think that that's actually key. What you just said is, I think, key to the way that we've been interested in approaching fan fiction, which is like it's about zooming in on the moment, and like I think for us, and like I think that's like a lot of the thing that drives fan fiction is that you have this story and there's satisfying parts and there's anticipatory parts, but you want more of a certain moment or a certain feeling, and you want to unpack a certain sensation, and then you kind of do it over and over and over again, and you like replay it on repeat, like a super cut of a tiny fragment. And like I think that's kind of what especially the newer version of Slash is about.
Gets into that like endless moment of yearning.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And you know,
I'm excited.
Yeah, and some because you know, I have other friends who enjoy literature on the archive of our own. And are more into like the smut stories or you know, stuff that maybe is you could put more in the category of like porn or erotica. But I think that the style of fan fiction writing, which has a strange consistency across canon consistency, is that the idea of like the people who are drawn to the figures who are drawn together and kept apart, and the kind of like desperate yearning. I want you. I don't want you. I can't say it. Will he say it? His hand touched my hand. And then it's like, for us, it's like we'll be reading, these like 72 chapter AU Sherlock Potterlock epics, and like, you know, reading it, walking down the street on your phone, walking into people, being that person on the train. And then it's like, as soon as they get into the sex, it's like, okay, I'm over it.
Yeah, I really feel that way.
And
I really feel that with fan fiction especially, I really, as soon as anything happens, as soon as there is any kind of consummation of the yearning, I'm not interested anymore. For me, that's what, because fan fiction for me is not about that. I mean, unless it's like...
No, it's about the yearning, right?
Unless, I mean, and that doesn't have to mean, you know, like, say it's a Sherlock fan fiction. Yeah. Like, they can be fucking and it can be explicit, but as long as they haven't said, I love you, or whatever it is.
Right.
Or they can be saying, I love you, but they haven't fucked. It doesn't really matter. As long as there's still that unresolved tension, I'm hooked. And then as soon as it's happening and it's about sensation and pleasure, I'm just like a... Like...
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what we wanted to make more
explicit.
At the forefront of... the new version of Slash.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
It's so tragic. I mean, it's so sad. I guess I just feel like masculine, quote-unquote, fandom is all about the cum shot.
Yeah.
And it's like there's this tragic element with this fandom of like you're so close to this thing, but you can never have it. And you're all, and there's a shame element to it because it's like
heavy shame.
Even
heavy.
The idea of slash fiction, it's like there's this self-relegation to the margins. Like it can only be it's tragic.
And I think back to Mists of Avalon. I think what's so appealing to me about Mists of Avalon, and it's I think why I didn't read the other books because I was so I kind of it kind of got it all from that one book. And in that book, to me, when I was reading it, I was always looking forward and looking back and thinking like, okay, they're gonna love each other or they did love each other, and it's never in the moment and it's always delayed.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you're like, oh, this scene when except they were lying in the grass, when that's when they were happy. Like that's when they loved each other, and it's you're never given the night of bliss. Like you're always it's always like it was lost or it hasn't happened yet. And so it really keeps you on your toes the whole time.
Mm-hmm. I have a theory that the Sinead O'Connor album Faith and Courage is a retelling of the Mists of Avalon.
I love it.
If you slow it down,
we have to stop.
And if you play it
like
backwards.
A Pink Floyd thing, it's like it ends with Pink Ari Ellison.
If you slow it down,
Emma's song. If you slow down Faith and Courage, and play it as you read the Mists of Avalon straight, it syncs up perfectly. It's like Pink Floyd and
so on the.
You guys should
keep going. Sorry.
There's like a light, a laser light show element.
Is there?
To Sinead O'Connor to Slash?
No. Just, I think maybe to future fan fiction endeavors for the both of you, but this is just me. I'm just top of the doming just here. You know what I'm saying? I'm just riving. Classic riff. Right.
Cool.
Okay.
Laser light show.
Laser light show.
Yeah, like the Dark Side of the Moon Wizard of Oz thing. Like, I just think there's just. I'll talk to you later about it.
But to me, that's almost antithetical because what I love so much about Slash is how stripped down and bare it is, which truly is a tribute to this like non-money-making margin shadow art form. So a part of me is like, I'm trying to imagine, because anything that gay men do, I like needs more of a budget always. But with what you two do, I'm like, no, they need to just be in like black smocks at all times.
Well, that's for this, interesting
not
that
for
you mentioned,
but for this.
Yeah. I'm so impressed that we're not reading as gay men.
No, that's why when I saw Slash, I was like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And it made me feel a lot of the things I felt like at comic conventions, which is like there is this movement that I don't understand. Mm. Like something I wanted to ask you guys. I was at New York Comic Con a few years ago, and there was a screening. It was before Jessica Jones had started. They did a screening of the first episode. And, you know, they did the surprise thing of, like, which cast members are here? And when they said that David Tennant was not in attendance.
I don't even want to know.
I don't want to know.
Like, there was,
did.
Like, the rights
there
of
was, there was a woman, not a girl, a woman behind me who let out this shriek from the bottom of her soul. And I remember being like,
tearing
what
her clothes,
happened?
Shaving her head.
It was beyond yearning. It was fever. It was like, it was pain. Mm-hmm. And it, that is not the, like, I come from the a space of like, well, this is my thing because I have nothing else, or this is this thing I'm obsessed with quietly, but I don't talk about it. And that's changed now that you have like hot gay guys on Instagram who are like, I love Marvel movies. Like,
right, and the changing of nerd culture in general.
But that is the real
it's different.
Deal.
It's
that
different.
Is something
the,
else.
The ululating, like Greek, the like Greek grieving hysteria of David Tennant is a new thing. It's not a new thing, but it's an invisible thing.
Yes.
It's an invisible thing.
It's ancient.
And I think like we right now, like part of what inspired Slash was our voyeuristic obsession with these mostly young girls on Instagram. Mm.
Some of them wouldn't call themselves girls.
Some of them are not. Yeah, some of them are not. That's what I'm saying. Mostly, it's like a largely feminine group, but it's not entirely. And like these mostly Sherlock obsessed girls, also Supernatural.
Who later got into Supernatural, which was hard.
And
for
Doctor
me.
Who, and yeah, but like they,
yeah, but, and the Doctor Who transition was weird too.
But the one that I think we're there's one that we're really obsessed with right now. I don't know who the person is, but the account is Shelley Stans.
Oh, yeah, Shelley underscore Stans.
Shelley, like Shelley, Mary Shelley,
yeah, like Percy Bysshe, like Percy Bysshe,
Percy Bysshe.
That is the faggiest thing I've
Shelley
ever heard.
Shelley underscore Stans, and Shelley Stans
it's the best.
Is like the best, most condensed exploration of that perspective sexuality, and it's like you. It's also also I want to give a shout out to a music video that has really affected us recently, which is by this musician, this new
native,
when we can talk about it more, but there's this musical artist named Samantha Echo. She's from the Upper West Side,
you're
like me.
Kill yourself.
And Samantha Echo has this new music video called
Nick's Mom.
Called Nick's Mom. Samantha Echo, Nick's Mom. And she has a post-it in the video on the wall that says, like, I've only a girl who's only had sex with Lord Byron's ghost.
Yes.
Isn't that the phrase?
Age 14.
Age 14.
Only boy she's ever had sex with is the ghost of Lord Byron.
And that's it.
And that's it.
Yeah. That's
but also Nick's mom is a very like explicit story of anguish in itself.
I mean, that's a whole
I think
there's also an essay called The Glass Coffin on Samantha Echo's website. You know, you can read about it in her own words.
Samantha Echo's one of the most important artists
of our generation.
Dealing with this stuff that we're talking about.
And the bravest artist.
And because she's indulgent, she's living it, but she's also has the distance of an academic, and she's reflecting on her identity and sexuality and cultural place and historical situation. I mean, she's really doing the work for all of us, Samantha Echo.
Yeah.
But this, you know, girl who's only had sex with the ghost of Lord Byron, like, that is the wailing over David Tennant also. I think that's connected. And I think it goes back that far, and it's like, and further. And it's like, you know, the women who literally wrote to the real Lord Byron.
Right.
You know, throwing themselves at him and like, you know, their sexuality being consumed with this unfulfillable fantasy.
After he was exiled.
After he was exiled for being... for being an incestuous, at
like age 22,
incest and buggery, and
and correct me if I'm wrong, but Shelley is the one who washed up on the shore on the rocks, right? So again, just noting that we're speaking with two Scorpios about Shelley, who whose body was found just kind of on the coast of Italy. Anyways,
and Lord Byron, Achilles and Patroclus style. Lord Byron burned his body
on the beach.
Corcordium, heart of hearts,
and you know, a non-Christian pagan.
Even though Lord Byron at that point was Catholic. Was a
did you guys
Catholic.
Read or watch Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell?
You know what? I had that book on my bookshelf for my entire middle school and high school, and then I threw it away. And I never throw away a book. So no, I don't know what – I have some
that's powerful, I think, because I forget who it was. Maybe like Borges or some shit, who said like the most important books aren't the ones you read. They're the ones that sit on your bookshelf and you don't read them and because you attach some magical.
That's exactly how I feel. Thank you, Borges.
Yeah, thank you.
So back to Samantha Echo. Ruby, I feel like you have some really – I really do think this is important to talk about right now.
Well, I think the Samantha Echo – also I just wanted to mention that we all three Leah, Emily, and myself, Ruby McAllister, we're all Venus Virgo.
Which is huge.
Which is huge about anguish and tragedy.
Please refer to the Channing Nicholas episode where I ask, why am I obsessed with Venus Virgo? But that's for reference. Keep going. Sorry.
Footnote.
Yeah, anguish, tragedy.
Cross archive. You can cross. Yeah. Right.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. the wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
But I think Samantha Echo, see, I am the collaborator of both Emily and Leah. However, I'm not a part of their mutual slash fiction obsession. But really, which gives me sort of an interesting vantage point to the Samantha Echo phenomenon. Because specifically, the song Nick's Mom is about essentially a girl who befriends her crush's mother and has, and the, okay, look at me.
I'm with you.
And music video is of Samantha Echo meeting Nick's mom in Bryant Park outside for coffee.
Okay.
And that nuance relationship and nuanced situation, location, everything.
Midtown.
So the music and the music video and the song sort of goes back and forth in terms of Samantha Echo's like intimate mythological Snow White.
It's themed. There's home movies of Samantha Echo's star-making performance in elementary school of her as the lead in Snow White as this beautiful child, intercut with her in the present, like grotesquely, like drinking a bottle of wine, wearing fairy wings, dressed and, as Snow White in her apartment.
And then, like, in her submerging herself in an Ophelia like way in the bathtub, maybe some like suicide, je ne sais quoi, thinking back to Nick's mom. You also hear in the music video a voice message from Nick's mom being like, which is iconic. This is iconic. I'm paraphrasing here, but it's ostensibly, "Hey, Samantha, long time no see. I just wanted to tell you that I am in a production of
that cool, that groovy upstate
Riverdale.
Groovy Riverdale theater production. Company.
In a production of Hamlet.
Playing Gertrude.
And I'm playing Gertrude.
Yes!
Wow.
Also,
wow.
I feel like I have to say that the video is also intercut with a detective, like, conspiracy-style bulletin board with pins and string, trying to figure out the secret of Samantha Echo's
arrested development
with clues, including, like, gets bullied by kids at school, obsessed with, wants to be a British man, which is only seen for a split second
and
cuts before you can really read it. Lord Byron's ghost is the only man she's ever had sex with. And so that's, and
it's this, it's such a beautiful, it's like the most brave, specific, nuanced piece of work of our time. And it also is sort of the other side of the slash fiction is like the reality of the existence, like the reality of the anguish that isn't in, like, couched in homoerotic fantasies.
I think before we get off Samantha Echo too, I think that music video is, if we're talking to me, if I was going to define the masculine and feminine in the context of this conversation, I would assign the feminine to this Samantha Echo video.
Okay.
And I would assign the masculine to the My Chemical Romance, I'm Not Okay.
There we go. And that is the binary we're working with here. Yes, and it is.
I'm not okay. It's so literalistic.
I'm not okay. And it's,
yes.
And it's the opening of the video when he says, you like D&D, Fangoria, Audrey Hepburn, and croquet.
Mm-hmm.
You can't swim, you can't dance, and you don't know karate. Face it, you're never going to make it. And Gerard Way says, I don't want to make it. I just want to... Guitar theatrics. And it's like...
Guitar theatrics.
And it's like Gerard Way... I mean, I could talk about Gerard Way all day, but it's like...
Absolutely, yeah.
He kind of forced himself into this. And actually, back to 9/11.
There we go.
Actually, right here. Gerard Way was this, like, nerdy kid who did comic book drawings. Mm-hmm. And then on 9/11... he had this revelation about mortality or his place in the world, and so he transformed himself into this, like, rock star, ambitious man, and fronted the band. And then, as he matured, went back to comic books.
Yeah, and
which
is
the
not as much of man anymore.
And is not as much of a man anymore. And I think that he really forced this, like, striving masculinity on himself. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to make it. I just want it. What does he want to do? And it's like, that is the masculine, and Samantha Echo self-destructing in the mm-hmm. bathtub mm-hmm. and being so honest about her marginalization, mm-hmm. like, and not seeing it in the context of like mainstream culture even, right. or like I think that's like the dichotomy.
Yeah, it's two different dichotomies of recognizing how stunted you are.
Is this because, I mean, if we take it back to like Byron and Shelley, is this, like the repository for the collective kind of poetic heartbreak that used to be expressed by the poets and actual writers and sages that now doesn't exist anymore? So now it's just kind of like feeling around in these convention floors and in this fiction. I mean, is it just like a transference of energy or what? Because it's
I think
real.
I think if we talk about fan fiction, I think women have always written outside of the publishing world. I don't mean exclusively. There's also the best-selling authors of all time are mostly women. So that's another idea. That, and largely fan fiction style writing.
And true. Shakespeare may have been a woman.
And Shakespeare may have been a woman.
Let's just say
it
was a woman.
Was.
But, like, I think that women... I think women are more likely to write without needing assurance that it will or could be published. And I think that Archive of Our Own is a kind of feminine space because it's anti-commercial,
right.
It's community-oriented, it's not so much about staking out, it's not as like colonial, like staking out territory as your own, making original content. It's like... It's not as imperial. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I think the world of like
nerd
poetry, even poetry or published poetry or novels, it's like, obviously there's women publishing and have been since the dawn of time. But I think like with Archive of Our Own and with like fan fiction communities, we are just seeing writing that we wouldn't have seen otherwise that would have been happening anyway.
Right. I would second that.
To me, there's always, yes, I agree with you, but I'm like, if I just think about most female authors, even 100 years ago, their whole thing from writing on the margins was that they were salty, smarter than the men, really subversive, often bleak. Like, I mean, this is such a boring example, but if I think about like Jane Austen or Dorothy Parker, everything they did was about like being more clever and less sentimental than the men. Now it's almost reversed, where we have like these man boys in the Marvel movies who are doing this kind of like post Judd Apatow, I'm in on the joke, but I'm actually not because I'm not funny because I'm a man and an idiot. And then you have these women who are like, I am going to rip my top off for David Tennant and cry and get on my knees and be as literally and purely emotional as I can be. So I just think there still has been some sort of an interesting switch. Not to contradict you, I think it goes in line with what you're saying.
I think there obviously have been female authors who have this kind of arch sensibility and overcoming their sentimentality.
Through displays of intelligence.
Yes.
Like aggressive displays of intelligence.
Mm-hmm. But for Jane Austen, like, there's an Emily Bronte, you know?
Right.
And, like, I think Dorothy Parker is, like, I mean, I actually don't even want to talk about Dorothy Parker. It's a whole other topic. But, like, I do feel like there is, when you're talking about, like, this shift Marvel movies, I think, like, and, like, yeah, the campification and the archification and the nerdification of, like, mainstream
the mainstreaming
culture.
Of, like, fanboy and culture.
And I think there is, like, I think that this goes to, like, a larger idea of, like, just a desperation for sensuality and, like, physical experiences or... And I think like fewer people are getting that from music, for instance. Like I think fewer people are like, you know, because they're listening to podcasts and they're not listening to music.
Yes, and I think that ASMR
I think the acquisition of information has become eroticized.
Yes.
And like you know, more and more people who are becoming the kind of person who like can't watch a movie without reading the trivia simultaneously. Mm. Like that used to be really for freaks like me. Like,
yeah.
You know, I like that. That used to be like I used to like when IMDb first came out,
right?
And we'd watch movies, and I would be on IMDb while we were watching the movies. Like that was a big no-no,
right?
And people were horrified. And now it's like people don't have – it's not just about the attention span, though. That's the thing. I think it's more and more about the sensuality of acquiring information and of stimulating your brain, and people are desensitized. So this screaming for David Tennant, it's like where are you going to get this – where are you going to get the swoon? Like what's going to make you feel, like really feel?
The Vietnam War – it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer. Streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
And like, and I think that, you know, women are certainly more conscious of being starved for it. I don't know if they feel it more, but they're more conscious of like the lack.
Mm-hmm. Look, I mean, sorry, go ahead, Emily. Sorry.
No.
I mean, we probably don't even have time to get into this. And I know Ruby and I can talk about this particular aspect for a while. But if you think about the 90s, again, pre-9/11, all movies, especially teen movies, there's a huge amount of male erotica. Like it's all about beautiful, beautiful men. Even like Sean Wayans was beautiful. Like gorgeous men, Freddie Prinze Jr., etc. And then of course you have like Radiohead. You do have this kind of then after that, I think everything
that
is still to me like kind of lyrical
romantic.
And elegiac and romantic. Like there's still this kind
pastoral.
Of gush of feeling.
Yeah.
And then that was, of course, all scrubbed clean in 2000, 2001. So I can definitely see when you put it that way, I'm like, oh, this completely makes sense. And I think like I've always wondered, like, where did this happen? And now I'm seeing what you're saying. Like there's a lack of romance and erotica in the world.
Yeah. And I think that. Like, you know, we're making a, can I say this? I'm in June.
What are we doing?
Potentially a video series.
Yeah,
Dis Magazine.
Which is now Dis Art.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah,
Dis Art. Is we are doing a collaboration with Dis Art and making a series of slash adjacent videos. And one of them is like a script we wrote that's in the style of a YouTube video of a like popular academic giving a lecture. Mm. Like, because I think, you know, that idea of like, where did the sensuality go? Where's the feeling? I'm so desensitized. I can't like get off to like, I've gone deeper and deeper into porn, even hardcore. I can't find anything. And it's like, where do you go? Like to the, and then it's like, do I go to the, pasture? Like, do I go to the woods?
Do I just listen to Astral Weeks on repeat?
Etc. And I think that, like, but there, you know, or like that idea of like, maybe I can just get off the phone. And then you get off the phone and it's not really an escape.
Mm-hmm. No.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're experimenting with going this other direction of going further into the like information economy and like trying to write like a Mark Fisher lecture that you know, in the style of like a boring 2-hour lecture that you put on as you're like cleaning your room and listening to, and then that gets interrupted by something. And like, is there a way out by going through, by like overloading and you know, finding some kind of like feeling or satisfaction or pleasure, getting into the pleasure of the like impossibility of release or something like that.
Listen, it behooves the two of you to figure this out, unfortunately, because I mean, I'm at a place where I'm listening to Annie Lennox Diva just over and over again. Like, I need something. Yeah. So if you guys can crack this code, as Ruby and I would say, if you can, like, uncover the demonology and help us return, it's essential that you
it's
do.
It's really, this isn't sort of like in our friend group. This is sort of like the underlying chronic topic. Is like in various ways, like even talking about friends, like that our mutual friends were like, well, if this happened with that person, it would
right
redeem the sexual, the lack of erotic energy in the world. And like, you know what I mean? Like we're constantly like fanficking our own friends. Shipping our own friends. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So we are kind of running out of time, I guess, unfortunately, because I feel like we've only just begun, which is terrible. And I know we didn't really get to talk much about Slash. I guess the last question I'd ask is, from Slash when it was in Chinatown to Slash now going to Joe's Pub, in terms of the changes that are made, are we looking at new characters being thrown in, or just
Shelley
redeveloping?
Shelley and Byron are now in Slash.
Okay,
yeah, they were in
the
original.
And also
they were in the original draft of Slash,
now we've put them back,
which was 4 hours long.
So, but they're rewritten.
Incredible extended cut.
The big change we've made, and I'm really interested to see what people think of this, is that in the Slash as we performed it in Chinatown, a lot of the content was adapted from or appropriated or stolen from fan fiction posted online, written by
probably
people
who 13-year-old.
Yeah, people we don't know.
Yeah.
And we replaced all that with original writing. So that's a big shift.
Yeah. Didn't know that.
Yeah, so we've rewritten the whole play so that it's stuff that we wrote. I mean, but there's still stuff that's collaged. Like, we still have Camille Polly and Susan Sontag are in it. Shakespeare is still in it. So there's still, and Joanna Russ's essay is still in it. But the fan fiction we have replaced with our own fan fiction.
Our own fan fiction.
So that's a big change. Yeah. And there's more
of a discussion about Betty and Veronica return and have a discussion about their childhood.
Oh, wow.
Their childhoods.
Yeah, and which is actually more about zooming in on the moment.
Yeah.
Getting into the yearning, like dissecting the yearning. Where did it start? What's the nature of it? So it's kind of like, it is more didactic, I think. Mm-hmm. But in being more didactic, it's also sillier.
Yeah. And I think that there's like, it's also shorter, partially because it had to be shorter for the venue it's going to. And so there's less of a, like, maybe less of, like, a schizophrenic, like, flexing of all the different, like, of many different fandoms. Mm. Like, it's a little bit more condensed. And to me, now it's more, like, I don't even really, you know, who knows? It's a mystery, but like it is a little bit, if we're talking, I think the feminine masculine dichotomy, which we've, said does not exist, but we are using it to talk about it, like that in a way it does feel this version is a little bit more vulnerable.
It's definitely more vulnerable. And it's also less about what you get and don't get. And there's stuff that is not meant to be got. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, in the Tiffany and Ivanka scene, we now have them lapsing into this other kind of dialect, which is like loosely based on Jean Genet's
A French translation.
The Maid.
A bad French translation.
But it's not in a way that is supposed to be recognizable. Like, it's just bad.
Yeah.
And it's just indulgent.
And it's just trusting the unconscious.
Yeah, and it's not like, it's not supposed to like tickle your recognition receptors in the same way that I think some of it was before.
Sorry we have to end this short, and I'm so grateful to both of you.
We're so grateful
to you.
You can follow Leah and Emily at Pretty Boys in Love
on Instagram.
/ hits Joe's Pub on June 10th. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you so much.